Okay.
Thank you, Zach, for asking me to do this. I hate talking in front of people. It's not my favorite thing. I remember in school, I hated it. I remember every time I was ever asked to do something and be honest, I hated it. So I'm up here, but I'm not going to hate it. We're just going to do it. But when he first asked, I thought, oh, God, yes. But then Zach said something really nice. He said, my first meeting I came to at this particular room, you were the secretary that night. And somehow it maybe helped you a little bit that night. And then you said it was so poetic how that works. And it's amazing how that works. Because I've seen it so many times in AA where one person just is in a room and then they become friends and then it turns around. So I love you, man. Thank you for asking me to do this. You changed the way I felt about it completely. Because at first I was like, God, and then what you said made me go, yeah. So thanks, man. my sobriety date is February 7th, 2013. It's not my first sobriety date, but that's okay. We'll get to that. I don't know when I had my first drink. I know my mom drank when I was in the womb. I know she smoked and drank, so sometimes I think I came out like, goo goo gaga vodka, you know, already ready, you know. But maybe not. I don't know. I got to see what alcoholism is. I got to see what it looks like up front and personal. My mom was, like I said, she drank then, and she continued to drink it when I was a little kid. And then, it's just the way it was then. And I saw how nasty alcoholism was. It was an ugly disease. It doesn't make anybody look cool. You don't look good. I mean, when you're in the throes of it. And she was in that part of the disease for years and years. She was like that. So. I saw people fall all over themselves. I saw things I never should have seen, but you know, that's the way it goes when you got an alcoholic in the family, you know, and I should know because I became that alcoholic. I remember being a kid and, you know, I found marijuana when I was about 11. Yeah. I started smoking cigarettes when I was around 11 too, which is horrific, but I found marijuana and I found it to be like a social thing to where I could fit in, you know, with a certain group of kids that were doing that. And it felt good to fit into any group at that age, you know. And I remember, but I would sit back and I'd be like, God, I'm never going to drink alcohol, bro. You know what I mean? How I really believe that was the bad problem and weed is going to be the solution. And this is going to be fun and everything like that, you know. And it was for a while. It did make things easier and it was fun and it had its good times, you know. And everything wears out though, because I'll wear it out. Eventually I'm gonna make it suck. It's just the way I kinda do it. I do it so much that it's not funny anymore, or funny, or good looking, or any of that stuff. I'll ruin it. I did that until I was about 16. But in that time, you know, I was going to school. I got in a lot of trouble in school. Even before I was smoking weed, before I was doing all that stuff, I was still a troubled child, you know. I definitely had ADD type things tell them the stories, but I wouldn't tell you all the stories, but there was some really stupid stuff I did. Like I chased cattle around town, you know, I would herd people's cattle and up into the mountains and just like, I don't even know what I was thinking. I would break windows in junkyards if I found cars. I would do all that stupid things kids do in the, you know, but I was destroying property and screwing with people's stuff at the same time. So I just didn't know where the limits were. And, you know, I was probably just waiting for that first smoke or that first drink just to ease all that crap. Because I don't know, I just had a lot of trouble. School was really hard for me. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't shut up. I couldn't pay attention. I didn't want to listen. I didn't want to pay, you know, all those things were really, really hard. I made it through most of my schooling without really anything too bad. I just didn't get very good grades. My parents probably not very proud of me. And it's just, they were constantly getting called to the school and things like that. My mom got sober. My mom got sober when I was about 14 years old. I'd gone to the counselor at our little school in Los Alamos. I grew up out in Los Alamos. And I went to that counselor and the counselor kept asking me questions about my mom. And I was like, I don't know. Because my mom taught me at a young age, you don't say anything that happens in this house, just shut up. And so I knew she just shut up. And one day she was talking to me and I don't know what happened, but I started crying and I told her, you know, my mom drinks a lot or something. This lady came to my mom's house, like the nicest, kindest lady. And she was in AA. And she asked her if she'd like to talk. And she just talked to my mom, you know, and she talked to her the way we talk to other alcoholics. And it was good, and she liked it, and then she asked her to come back again, you know. She was drinking, you know. And then she came back again, and she talked to her again. And about three times, she talked my mom into going to, I think it was called Pinecrest in those days, going to a rehab. And my mom went. And our lives changed, you know. It was just a 180 from chaos and the way alcoholism is, and watching my mom fall down and just make a fool of herself to stand up, become such a strong, powerful person that was in recovery and was able to do all kinds of cool things later. I'll talk more about that. But to see that transformation, man, what a trip, you know. And I was still smoking weed, though, right? I didn't want to quit smoking pot. I go, Mom, do I got to quit? Am I going to have to? Because you're, am I going to? And she goes, no, you're fine. You know, you can still smoke, honey. I'm not going to ruin it. Oh, God, no. And she got home. She was like, you know. And then for like 2 years, she let me just kind of eke by on smoking weed, you know. And then finally, they're like, that's it. I don't know what we were thinking, saying you can smoke weed. So they started drug testing. And that drug testing was that. And then, you know, about 6 months went by. I got clean off that weed. And somebody showed me alcohol. I drank it before when I was younger, but I didn't care about it. It wasn't something that looked good or felt good, or I didn't want to do it. But man, it was such a change. It was such a, from going from smoking weed to getting sober to then finding this thing. It was like magic compared to being sober, compared to being stoned out. This made me feel like alive, you know? And I don't know if it's a chemical thing or what it is in my body, but it brings out like this thing in me, and I'm louder, I'm happier, I don't know, man, I'm fearless. All the things that I was scared of go away. I'm not scared of them anymore. All the things I was shy about, I wasn't shy about anymore. I just didn't really care. And it made me like feel like I fit into social places better. You know, my social group changed. I went from all the stoner dudes to all the drinker guys, I don't know, and hanging out with those kind of people, and it was like fun, and there were girls involved. Like stoner guys don't have a lot of girls hanging out. There was girls hanging out with the drinker guys. Like, it's amazing, you know, what a change. And it was fun, and it was fun, and it was fun for a long time. It was fun, and you know, I drank too much. My first bout with it was, we did it for a summer. And then we came back to school the next year, and we drank only on the weekends. And then that next year was summer, or the next year was senior year. And I remember I wanted to drink during the week suddenly. Suddenly I started thinking that drinking during the week would be okay. And we were drinking more during the week and getting a little bit more hammered all the time. And I caught my first DUI at 18. I think I had my license for a year or something like that. Got a DUI. Didn't really think much of that because, you know, I was young and stupid, and it didn't seem like that big of a deal. And it really wasn't in those days. The laws were a lot different. It wasn't like today, man. You get one today and you're dead. But then it was still something, and I still didn't see it as a disease by any chance. I definitely seen what alcoholism looks like, and I knew that I didn't look like that still. And I knew that anybody I was hanging out with then did not look like that. So, you know, I could compare it to all those people I saw. And as long as I wasn't like that, I'm not an alcoholic, right? I mean, that's the way I looked at it. Nor did I ever think about that word alcoholic for myself. I'll backtrack a little. When I saw my mom get sober, she had AA meetings at her house. And so I had my first bout with AA people was these older ladies that my mom would have at her house. I was 14 or 15. I would be out in the jacuzzi just smoking out. And then I would come in the house right after their AA meeting and just talk to them all. And they were so friendly and really cool. And I was really stoned. And I remember this one lady, Ginny. Remember Ginny? She goes, oh, there's something wrong with that ball. To this other lady, Marilyn. And they were just sitting there staring at me. And my paranoia kicked in, I remember. They're like, they know. And they did know. So I'll never forget that, man. You remember them, Ginny and Marilyn. Pretty nice old ladies. And what a trip, man. What a cool experience to get to know what AA was, because what I knew is it saved my mom. That's what it did. Save my mom. Yeah. So, you know, I got that DUI. Things started going downhill. I had a small job. I was out of school now. I was trying to go to Hancock. Ugh, I hate school. And so I'm doing all this stuff, just barely making it by on what my dad will put up with, you know, basically. And I got too drunk one night, and I came home, and I said, I came home, and they dropped me off at 9 p.m. I thought it was like 11:30 or 12, but it was 9 p.m., and they were wide awake. And I walked in the door kind of all hammered, and they, oh, my God, it was on. My mom's sober. My dad doesn't want me drunk in our house, you know. So I remember I screamed at my dad. I told him, let's go, fool. And thank God he didn't smash my face in that day, because he could have. And he took me outside, and he goes, hey, just shut up and go to bed. You know, just go to bed. And I remember going to bed, and I woke up in the morning. This is what I will never forget. I remember going, was that real? You know, when I woke up, no, right? And I got up, and I walked out, and there was no one there. And I looked out front, and I opened the door, and my bags were all packed. And they were out there waiting for me. And because my mom was done with it. She was done with the games. And so she said, that's it, you're out, fool, you know, or whatever. And I was like, ah. And so I said, can I join the military? What if I join the military? And she said, yeah, okay. Join the military for reals, and you that's fine, you can stay. So I joined, got in the Navy. I had to get a waiver for that DUI I got, you know, and I didn't see it then, but I was an alcoholic already. And I was waiting to find a new home, and the Navy was it, man. Those people drink, you know what I mean? Oh. I found people like to party, you know, and they go out to sea, and then they get wherever they get, and then they get hammered. So I fit in perfect with those people. And that went good. I didn't really get in much trouble there. I just perfected alcoholism, I think, a little bit. And no more DUIs, nothing like that. Got out of the military. I got married. That went good for a while. And I like to say my wife or hostage, whatever, when you know what I mean? Because kind of she was kind of a hostage in that, because that wasn't fair to her. I was drinking so much then. And she was trying to help me not be like that. And I just couldn't stop myself. I didn't know why I couldn't stop myself from doing it. I don't know why I couldn't stop myself from pulling these little stupid ass tricks. Like, I would come home and I thought I cracked the code. And because she didn't want me drinking before I got off work, got home. So I cracked that beer right as I walked in the door. Hi, honey. Yeah, like this. And like, as if, you know what I mean? That's how stupid little games I was playing. And I was lying constantly. And I wasn't cheating on her, but lying is terrible. And I was drinking after work every day, you know, and just sitting in bars. And that marriage fell apart, of course. But thank God for her, you know, thank God for her. She didn't deserve all that crap. And then the marriage kind of fell apart, and I was in construction at this time, and I found out this thing called methamphetamine. And oh my God, I liked it, you know. I never did this before. That weed ain't like that, you know. Holy crap, this stuff is vroom vroom. And for me, it's kind of different because, like, my ADD, I get kind of chill. Mine's less vroom vroom, more like focused energy. You know, it's very strange. But I found that stuff, and that was awesome for a while. Again, I'm picking up DUIs as I go. I've got another one by now. No drug charges yet. But what I found out was every time I drank, I wanted the drugs. Every single time. And I love drinking every day, so I want drugs every day. And I can't remember. I catch that other DUI, and I get a court card. And they send me in here, and I come to the meetings, and I think, oh, it's so stupid. They all hold hands. I'm holding a man's hand. Gross, you know? It was so stupid to me at that time. And I made it like 3 months. I didn't want to be here, so it didn't really mean anything. Couple years, you know, I got out, went back out, didn't mean anything, and kept drinking and kept drugging, kept drinking and kept drugging. And then about 2 years later, you know, I really started to want it again. And I like to look at it like this. Well, I'll backtrack a little bit. But me and a friend of mine had been up in a party doing stuff in Pismo, and it was all crazy and it was all fun. And then it turned into a big street fight with a bunch of different people. And it was, that was fun to me too, I know. But that was, you know, and fed that crazy thing in my head. And next thing you know, that friend turned on me. And we were going to fight each other. And I remember thinking, God, if we fight, we'll never be friends again, probably. You know, and I was like, And he was just saying, yeah. And what I remember was we were driving home. We didn't get in that fight. But what I remember him saying to me is he looked over to me in the car as I was driving home, and he goes, Marcus, I'm so sorry I did that. I can't believe that happened. I promise I'll never do it again. I promise, man. And I thought, bull crap, dude. You can't promise me that you won't do that again. You have no idea whether or not you'll do it again. And I know how I know that is because I do that to people all the time. I promise them all the time that I won't do it again, but I still do it again because I don't have any control once I take a drink. And he had no control when he takes a drink. It's just what's going to happen. You can't promise me anything. And I never seen a mirror so clear as I saw it that night, you know, in that guy's face. And I quit drinking that night. I poured my beers out. And I was like, I'm quit, blah, 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 you know. And the next morning, when I came in when I was 26 years old, I met a couple of old timers that were really kind, you know, Hank Hoffmeyer and a couple other, Jim Sabo and a couple other guys, and Victor. And I came back at 28. That next morning, I woke up. My mommy was done with me by this. My parents, this is later in life, and they said, don't ever come back to this house. We don't ever want to see you again. Don't come back here until you're sober. I'd say, bye-bye, you know. And like, I went about 4 months out there like, I don't even care, man. But I cared, and it started eating away at me. I think that contributed to me getting sober. But that morning, I called my mom up, and I said, you know, because I know she knows. I said, how do I do this? Crying, I need to get sober. I don't know how, you know? And she said, go to the 5 o'clock meeting at the Pyramid Group. So I go, and it was 6 o'clock and I was late and I missed it. I was crying and I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna definitely drink, you know? And she goes, well, and I needed to find Hank Hoffmeyer is what it was. I needed that guy because he was so nice to me. I thought, man, if I could stay sober, that guy could help me. And he was right here in this room when it's 7 o'clock, this meeting we're in right now. She goes, go try the 7 p.m. meeting, see if he's there. And there he was. And he kind of held my hand and put his arm around me during the meeting. And he told me it was going to be okay. And we listened to Glenn speak. He was a speaker that night. And Glenn was up here, I swear to God, and he was talking and talking. And he was saying all the shit you don't say out loud. He was telling all the stuff that I know in my heart, but I would never tell anybody. About how pitiful, incomprehensible, and demoralizing this is. And how crappy of a person I am when I drink. And I mean, I couldn't believe it. I swear I stood over where Morgan is. I just cried and cried because I'd never heard the truth like that. Even though I'd been in the meetings before, my ears were being closed. I didn't care what you said that day. But this time I cared. And I heard Glenn so clear. And it meant so much to me. I even asked him to be my sponsor afterwards. He helped me with all kinds of stuff. And he was amazing, man. You're an amazing guy. You're a good friend of mine and forever. And got me out of trouble. I remember I had some warrants. And I was like, I'm not going in there. Glenn goes, let's just go and we'll just tell him and we'll just give him some money. And I was like, I don't think we need to do all that. Glenn's like, I'll pay. And I go, I don't think you should do it. And freaking Glenn, man, talked me into it. And I went in there and I threw myself on the mercy of the court. And no big deal, you know? I was terrified to do that. I didn't believe in honesty at that point, you know? They'd catch me when they catch me, you know? and you were not about that, so you saved me, dude, from that. And I remember that night when I came to this meeting, and the meeting was over, and I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, what do I do now? You know, what do I do now? Do I go out and do I just drink now? Because I think I might, you know? And Lee was here, and Hank was here, and Hank told Lee, he goes, take Marcus to the 8:30 meeting, because there used to be another meeting after this. And Lee drove over there, and I followed him, and I'll always be thankful for him for that, because it saved me. You know, he had his family with him. He didn't want to go do all that crap, but somebody told him, go help that newcomer, and he went and helped that newcomer. So, you know, it's amazing how it comes all the way around still like that. You know, my sponsor and I went over the 12 steps. Me and Glenn were that way for a long time. Then I got another sponsor named Woody, and he's my sponsor to this day. We went through the steps. It was amazing. I didn't get some of the feelings I thought I was going to get from this, but I got it from that. You know what I mean? And for me, making those amends and cleaning up my side of the street was everything. That was everything in the steps. 4 and 5, admitting it, I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. Woody goes, you're going to love this part, dude. And I was like, I didn't think it was that great. But I love getting that off my chest and feeling free. And I made some cool amends, some things I did that was just shitty of me. I could be a bad person when I'm drinking and sober, but if you hurt my feelings when I'm drinking, I hurt yours back. You know, that's how everything was, retaliatory. Today, I try to never feel like that. I don't want to retaliate. You step on my toes, I just want to step the other way. I really don't want to get mad like that. But I used to love it and live for it. You know, I told a guy I was sorry for embarrassing him in front of a bunch of people. I know it's a stupid little amends, but this one meant a lot because I had to go hunt that dude down on job site after job site after job site. And I finally found him. I went up and told him. He goes, "I don't care." I was like, "That's cool. It's cool, man. That's cool." And he goes, "Thank you, though, Marcus." And I go, "You're welcome." But it meant everything to me. I cleaned that up because I know I took advantage. I took advantage of a lot of people and a lot of things. If I had a skill and you needed it, I'm taking advantage. That's just how it was, you know. Anyway, pretty cool how it works. I went over those steps. Life got good. I found a girl. I met a girl in here. We got married. We had a kid. Life got really busy. I mean busy. Like, I was doing stuff, man. I was important in those days. I got important. Yeah. It was like 9 years, and I was super important at that point. And I can't be going to all these damn meetings. Shit. I would, but I got to do all that. You know, and about 9.5 years when it all just boom exploded, you know, because what happened really was this. It wasn't like I went out and relapsed and I fell over my shoestring, because I could do that. It could be that way, but it wasn't. It was me slightly, slowly unworking the program. See, in 4, 5, and 6, and 7, I made an agreement and a promise to God that I would stop doing this stuff that got me to where I'd been. I would stop stealing. I would stop lying. I would stop purposely hurting people or any of that. I would just stop. God, if you'll just help me get clean and sober, I promise I'll stop doing that. You know, and then what did I do? I started unwinding all those things. You know, I got important, like I said, and you know, I had to be a dad now. I got to be a provider. I own a house, for God's sakes. I own my own business. I mean, it's hard to like stay up with all the rules in AA. And slowly but surely, I just unwound the program. I didn't even see it happening. I started. Most of you know, but I went into Home Depot, and they forgot to ring up a couple of the boards, and I didn't say anything, you know, right? No big deal. But for me, that's huge, you know, because that's the beginning. That's the very start of a little slit in my promise that I wouldn't do anymore. And it's a little lie to God all of a sudden I'm doing. Real quick lie to God. And the next time I went in there, I got about 4 or 5 of them for free, and I knew it this time. I did it on purpose. And then the next time, about 10 or 11. And then consistently, I was stealing. Like that. You know why? Because they trusted me. They trusted that when I said I have 110 boards, they go, he's an honest guy. And I was using that honesty that AA gave me to lie and steal. And I still didn't think that much of it. But my program was falling apart and I stopped going to meetings as much. I felt like everything else was more important than AA. I maybe had a service commitment or two, but not much. And at 9.5 years, I have a brain tumor. You guys can see something wrong, but what is it? I have a brain tumor behind this eye. And I've been at places where I had to take pain pills, and I was real honest, and I've been at places where I had to take pain pills, and I was real dishonest, you know, so. I felt the spectrum and the gambit of that, but I started getting real dishonest, you know. And then I wanted to backtrack back out of it, so I was taking like a quarter of a pill, just trying to keep the drug addiction off of me. I just want to stay in the. I don't want to relapse. And I had made a plan. To sell. I've never told this ever, but I made a plan to sell a bottle of pills for like $3,000. They're OxyContin. And I could get them like that if I wanted. And I went and got them like that. And I got the wrong kind, and they were generics, and they wouldn't sell. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, then I'll take it. And I took one. And I just popped a pill. An OxyContin. I went from a quarter of a Vicodin to an OxyContin. Because I was burp about the whole thing. And that was definitely a relapse right there. But until I put that thing on a piece of tinfoil and I hit it with a lighter, that's when I really knew I relapsed. And I still came right up to this podium and I took that 10-year cake, you know. It's sick and demoralizing, and I felt terrible about myself. But I didn't want you to know yet. I wasn't ready to confess that I was a relapser yet, you know. And then as soon as I did confess and relapse, I fell into a shell and a hole that I can't imagine I ever came out of. John visited me there once. I went into a place where I'd won all those things, that house and that those kids, and I got that cool life and I got a business, and I lost every single thing of that except for that house for a little bit. I had that for a little bit, and I was just living in there in the drug world, and it was absurd. They say that your disease is still out there and it's doing push-ups waiting for you. I never took a needle and put anything in my arm until I relapsed. And next thing you know, I learned what heroin was. Because those pills, they only last so long. I got to sell them. There's only so many reasons. And la, 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 la. And then next thing you know, I need heroin. And I'm slamming heroin and meth, you know. And that's a place I never thought I'd go, you know. Going from drinking beer. I hadn't planned on getting sober. It wasn't like I was like, oh, good, I can't wait to get back there. Because people would call me from AA and they would say, Marcus, how are you? And I would just answer the phone and hang up, or I'd not answer the phone. Woody was my best friend and still is. And I wouldn't answer the phone for him. And he'd knock on my door and I wouldn't answer the door. And I wouldn't let you in because I love drinking and using, you know. If I drink and use, I don't want to go back to AA. If I'm in AA, I don't want to go back to drinking and using. But man, you put a little in me and I'm gone. So there's a pretty valuable lesson in that for me, is that one is too many and a million is never enough, or something like that. But that's true for me. Every single time, if I ever take a sip or pop another pill for something, I could be off and running. And I am a miracle that I made it back here. What happened was I got a couple more DUIs. Well, at least one more at that point. So I had three DUIs, some drug charges now. Things weren't going good. And I didn't have that house anymore. Now I'm living in a car. I got my dog next to me. And I fell asleep in that car one time, and the cops got me in another charge. And I started trying to fight for my kids, because my wife took my kids quite easily, by the way. It was not hard. And I was like, I got a fancy lawyer. I paid him good money, big money. And I caught another DUI in the process of the court case for my children. I got a DUI, so no custody for him. Pretty obvious they weren't going to give me custody, and I could, rightly so. But I didn't want to be this way. I don't want to be an addict and an alcoholic, but I just can't stop myself once I start. I love it too much, you know. I hate that, but it is what it is about me. So my wife got the kids, custody, full custody. I got nothing. And she told me, you either go to recovery or you'll never see him again. And I was like, yeah, I should do that. You know, and I wanted to do that. But I still was out there, you know. And I got another charge. Finally, I got this fourth DUI. And the cop brought me into the hospital. Because of this tumor, they always take me to the hospital. And the cop had me handcuffed, and I was crying, oh, my life is over, man. And the cop was really cool. He was like, your life isn't over. And I go, my life is over. I'm never going to see those kids again, bro. And he was like, dude, your life isn't over. You're fine. You're going to get a DUI. You're going to get in trouble. You're going to be okay. And he said, hold on. Well, like I was going anywhere. I was handcuffed to the thing. I wasn't going anywhere. I'll be right back. And he goes to his car, and he gets his phone, and I think a photo album, and he starts going through pictures, and he goes, see these people, Marcus? They're not okay. They're never coming back. And he showed me people that died from drinking and driving. Wow. And he showed me things in his phone of people died of drinking and driving. And he said, you're okay. Your life isn't over. Theirs is, you know. I have all these angels that keep popping in my life all the time. And I don't see it at the time, but I remember seeing it that day going, God, you know, And I get in these drug courts, and I get in all this stuff, and I'm on full-on probation, and all this, you know. And man, I mean, they are scrutinizing me. I'm in Veterans Court, and they're just waiting for me to drop the ball. And again, I get a dirty drug test after 8 months of being clean, of like sitting on my hands completely. I catch another charge, and they go, "That's it, McCoy. You know." And they throw me in detox. So it wasn't it. They gave me one more chance again. They threw me in that detox facility right here. And I remember I got in that bed. I sat down in that bed. And I just exhaled like this. And I had no more moves. I had no more shakes, no more jibes, no wiggles, no moves, no talks, no shit, nothing. I couldn't get out of anything. I'm trapped here for sure. And I don't know what to do. And I'm ready to surrender. And I surrendered. That day again, once again, God gave me a bottom. Once more. One more time, I get a bottom. There's so many people out here that don't ever find a bottom. That don't ever find a bottom sufficient to stay clean and sober. But I've gotten two of them, you know. And I don't deserve one of them. Not necessarily. I don't deserve it any more than anybody else does. But yet I've gotten two of them. Pretty amazing. I'm grateful today that I got thrown in that detox. And that they made me do, a meeting in the morning and a meeting in the afternoon, a meeting in the night. And they said, do 90 meetings. And I had this 10 years or 9.5 years, but I'm telling you, your relapse, you will just forget everything, you know? And so it was cool to get reinvigorated in detox. And I kept that, and I kept going and stayed sober that way. And my life got good again, got my stuff back, got respect back. People cared about me again. And again, I still haven't relapsed since then, but I'm telling you, I've been this close before. And it's just because I just stopped coming to meetings quite as much, and I stopped talking to you guys as much, and I don't participate as much, and my otherworldly problems become big, and this becomes smaller, and it can happen, man. And a year and a half ago, I was at a jumping off point and broke up in a relationship, and I was in a funk, And I wasn't that I wanted to drink or use. It was just, I can't believe I didn't, you know. Sometimes when I look back, I can't believe I didn't. Because I was so unhappy, and I just didn't know it, you know. You get used to unhappy. You can get used to that. I get comfortable there. And I found a men's group. It was the Wednesday night men's group and the Thursday night men's group over in Orchid. And I went in there, and I told them the truth, and I said, I don't know, man, but I don't think I'm going to, you know, I'm feeling like this, and this. And those guys put their arms around me, dude. And, man, I'll never be able to thank them enough, because my program slowly started getting better. You know, the BS meter, I was full of shit at that point still. You know, I had become that way again. And today I'm praying like I'm losing that, you know. That's what I want to be. I want to be an honest person again without all the BS that I had been telling myself and stuff. Even sober, I don't, you know. And I started going to more meetings, and I started being of service in more meetings. And if you call me and ask me to do something, I'll probably always say yes. There has to be a really good reason not to. Tonight after this meeting, I'm driving to Los Angeles to go to UCLA for this. It's a brain tumor, and it's gotten bad in the last year, but thank God my program got good, you know, because those two are kind of contradicting each other and counterbalance, and it could be way worse, man. I could be relapsed right now and this happening, dude. You know, God each time looked out for me. When this happened, I'll tell that story. When this happened, I was about 9 months sober the very first time at 28 years old, and I came in, and I was so scared of the people in the rooms. I would come into these meetings, and I'd be like, come in right on time. I'd listen, I'd be like, yeah. Boom, and gone. I was gone right when that meeting was like, boom, I'm out of here. Because I don't know how to communicate with other people. Especially, it wasn't that I looked down on anyone, it was that I looked up to them all, you know? Because they all talk so well. All the people I was hanging out with when I was drinking and using were, duh, you know, just like me. You know, we're idiots. And these guys were like so with it, so, you know, to me, you sound like you were very smart and intelligent, And I just didn't feel like I could fit in. I just, man, you guys knew your emotions and what all this stuff about yourselves. I didn't know any of that stuff. And this brain tumor, man, I got this patch. I had to wear this patch because my eye turned in 15 degrees. At work, working for Foxwood Realty, everything was great in those days. And then all of a sudden, boom, this brain tumor happened. And I thought, oh my God, my life is ruined, la, 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 la. And then I come to a meeting, and I swear to God, I have the patch on, and somebody comes up and goes, "What's up?" And he asked me, "What's wrong?" And I told him, blah, blah, blah. And then another one comes up, another one comes up, and another one comes up, and another one comes up. And suddenly, everybody was asking me, "How are you? Are you okay?" And I can't believe it, but this thing probably saved me, kept me here. Because I may have been, I may not made it, because I wasn't fitting in, I didn't understand how to be part of, and I was just kind of on the outskirts. And you guys saw this and jumped on me, you know, and made sure I was going to be okay and stuff. And I, what a crazy story. The brain tumor may be the thing that kept me sober all this time. And whether or not I relapsed or not, you know, I've had so much good times in the program. Even though, you know, I can't count it all in one run, because that ain't how it works. But you know what? I had a good little 9-year run, and I've had a good little 12-year run, man. And I want to keep this one going, man. And I'm just so thankful to get a chance to live this cool life. About a year ago, at that same time as the relationship went crazy and my life changed, my dad took his car and ran into the neighbor's house. Boom, boom. And then I just happened to be cruising down that to my dad's to visit to see how he was doing. And he was driving into the garage of the neighbor, like smashing, smash, smash. And I was like, Dad, whoa, whoa, whoa. And he goes, huh? And I go, what are you doing? And he goes, ah. Like, he wasn't even sure what was going on. And it was the beginning of like either sundowners or not really Alzheimer's, but it's something, you know. And it was bad that day. And he had a terrible, anyways, bottom line, I had to move in with him. I didn't share about my dad in the beginning of this thing, but me and him had a great relationship as a little kid, but as soon as I smoked that pot, I smoked those cigarettes, he didn't know how to put up with that shit, which I totally understand. Like, can you imagine an 11-year-old kid smoking cigarettes and weed? I wouldn't like it either, but I was doing it anyways. And our relationship took a turn over those years, and we'd never been close, you know? And so to find out that I got to move in with him and take care of him, and I don't even want to help, you know, even though I've done the steps and all this stuff, I still got other old resentments. I don't want to do all that stuff I got to do. And I do it anyways because I know I got to do it because no one else, I don't have any brothers or sisters. And I move in with him and my sponsor goes, "You're so lucky. I'm so jealous." And I go, "What are you talking that for?" You know, because this is not good. Don't act like it and don't try to trick me. You know, and he was like, because you're about to embark on a journey in life that is going to blow your mind. You and your dad are going to become friends. And I'm like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, Woody. You know, that is so stupid. Please don't say stupid shit. You know, and I swear to God, I mean, it's been a year now. It is the truth. We're freaking friends. I really care about him. We laugh together today. We never laughed before together. I care about what happens to him. And I take him to all his appointments and I cook for him every single day. And I drive him to what he needs to be driven to. And we are friends, you know. I mean, I'm not saying we're out there, "Hey, I love you too," you know, it's none of that. But it doesn't have to be. It's shown. It doesn't have to be said, you know. That's a pretty good gift. I didn't think I deserved that, especially after all the fighting and stuff we've done. And to think I could have missed it all, you know. I could have missed it. My pride and ego could have kept me from that, you know. There was a point in that I was like, I'd just rather put him in a home, shoot, you know. Stupid, you know. Anyways, that didn't happen, thank God. I'm gonna tell a little story and then I'll probably wrap it up right there. Last thing I was thinking was, some of you heard me tell this one before, some of you haven't, but I heard a lady up here, it was 24 years ago, when she was up here at this podium, right here. She was telling this story about a guy that goes to heaven. And he goes to heaven, and he goes and he talks to one of the angels, and the angel says, "Oh, hey, da, 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 come on in this room. I want to show you where you're going to be going," right? And he goes, "All right." And the guy goes in the room, and he sees all this giant table with all this beautiful food and all these people, and everybody seems like they're having fun. And then he gets up a little closer, and the closer he gets, he sees the people all have these giant spoons, and they're all trying to eat this food, and they all can't get it in their mouth. And they're all trying to feed themselves. And they're all skinny and dying and emaciated. And he goes, "God, I don't want this. This is terrible. I don't want this." And the guy goes, "Okay, come on." And he takes him to another room and he goes in the room and it's the exact same thing again. And he walks in, and there's that table, and there's those people with all those spoons, and they got them all up like this, and everybody just seems like they're yelling and screaming, but this time they're more like singing and laughing. And they're reaching over, and they're feeding each other with that spoon. Everybody's feeding each other, right? I get emotional, because that's AA, man. We all come in here broken, messed up, and without anything to give, and somehow we all feed each other with this shit, whatever it is we've got to go through. And that's a miracle, man. That's a miracle. Because I was a taker and a leaver. I everything was about me. And today, we give to each other so that we can feel good about ourselves. That's crazy. What a cool concept. That's all I got, you guys.